we have who used to be a denizen of LSE London, in fact maybe one of the founders of LSE London as such, as we think from the Greater London Group, descended from. But after that, he was at LSE as a reader in social policy, I think. Went to Bristol as a professor, then fell amongst government people, worked for the strategy unit in the Cabinet Office in the Blair era.
Yes.
To look back historically. The Greater London Authority as Director of Housing.
Very good. ODPM, Director of Urban Policy.
Director of Urban Policy. helped negotiate the peace treaty between
the
And now he says he's Assistant Director, Economic and Business Policy, Greater London Authority. When Mark was here and working on the Working Capital book with Michael Harlow and Peter Hall and myself, and the book on London politics with Dave Shadows, one of his contributions was thinking about new roles for local authorities and for government. And when people were talking about whether the state should be steering or rowing, Mark added two other roles for the state and for local authorities, which was waving or drowning. we want to hear tonight whether London is waving or drowning, whether the GLA is doing both of those things. Mark.
Okay.
London's diverse economy.
Thanks very much, Ian. Yes, one's words come back to haunt one later on. I'm going to talk today about the Mayor's economic development strategy, and I want to put this in the context of London's economy. And I was thinking, I thought a lot about this title, and I was trying to get across the idea of a complex economy without using the word rebalancing, because I don't like the idea of rebalancing the economy for all sorts of ways. So I've come up with London's diverse economy, which was the sort of nearest I could get to it while Christine was hassling me to come up with a title so she could get the programme out. But hopefully I'll give you a flavour of what I want to talk about. I'm going to start by just skipping through some key facts about London's economy, most of which I'm sure are very familiar to people in this room, but I think they do bear repeating, because while a number of things in terms of policy and politics have changed, these underlying drivers of the London economy remain constant. First of all, to make the most obvious point, it is a huge global city economy. And we've seen that between 1996 and 2008, there was jobs growth in London of about 800,000. And we stick to our forecast that's in the London Plan and the Economic Development Strategy, that even including the effects of the recession, we're expecting to see jobs growth of roughly the same order of magnitude, so about 750,000 jobs by 2031, so over the next 20 years, taking that to 5.45 million jobs in total. So London continues to be a huge jobs machine. It's an international centre of trade and innovation, and has been so for centuries. It's a resilient economy, I'm going to argue, because it's diverse. And many people here, although sadly not I, would have been at Henry Overman's lecture on Friday, where I'm sure he went into this aspect of it in a lot more detail and a more subtle analysis that I'm going to have time for today. But I think this point about diversity equals resilience, to put it at its simplest, is very important. And I think that's true of urban economies in general, but I think it's London is a case study for that. And finally, London remains in a strong and globally competitive position. Oops. Can I go backwards? Hang on, I've already messed it up. Yeah. Okay, so those are the strengths. Need to balance that really by looking at what the potential threats to London's economy are. First of all, a whole range of threats to competitiveness. So this is an economy which sinks or swims by its internationally competitive position. So any threat to that competitive position is going to be very important for London's economy. And by threat to competitiveness, I'm including everything from the sheer fact that there are more competitors decade by decade or year by year. In other words, there are cities around the world that are growing. There are cities which, there are established global cities. There are other cities which are not in the top category of global cities, but have aspirations to be there and are taking active steps to, if you like, move up the league table. So it's, I think the key thing with global city competitiveness, it's always like, you know, running up the down escalator. You have to put an enormous amount of effort, even to just staying in the same position. So that's one kind of threat to competitiveness. We're also very alive at the GLA, and the mayor is very alive, to potential policy or regulatory impacts on London's competitiveness. And here we are very focused on the fact that for London to compete as a location with other similar cities worldwide, we need a playing field that's level globally. In other words, if we have a more restrictive regulatory or taxation or legal system here than we do in New York or Shanghai or somewhere else, we are going to lose market share. And we saw that happen between New York and London, to London's favour, after Sarbanes-Oxley. And there's potential issue on the horizon in terms of, are we going to move to a more globally regulated system, let's say in financial services, or are we going to end up with a kind of unilateral new regulatory framework which can work to London's disadvantage. So those threats to competitiveness can take a range of forms. Secondly, in terms of threats or perhaps weaknesses, we know in London we have a major problem both with worklessness and with low skills. Now, on worklessness, the great paradox of the London labour market is, although this is a fantastically successful economy, and although in terms of GDP per head and productivity and so on, London far outstrips the other regions in the UK, we have either the worst or the second worst employment performance of all the nine regions in England. So we have this paradox that you have a successful economy that generates hundreds of thousands of jobs every year, but many London residents are not able to access those jobs for a whole variety of reasons. So there's an issue around worklessness, and there's a related but also separate issue around skills. The skills base of the London workforce, although it continues to improve, and there have been huge improvements over the last couple of decades, it's not improving as fast as the demand for skills is increasing. So again, it's like running up the down escalator, that, okay, we're improving the skills of the workforce, but the demand, as the economy moves further and further towards let's call it a knowledge-based economy, for, you know, as a shorthand, the more it moves towards a knowledge-based economy, the more that level of skills that's demanded, even for entry-level jobs in London, goes up. So there's a gap between what a lot of the workforce have in terms of skills and what is required. And even if you look at people who are employed, that process of upskilling and making sure people are ready for the challenges of the next wave, we are struggling really to keep up with the demand for that. Thirdly, responding to climate change, and the UK government and the mayor in particular have very ambitious targets for climate change and carbon reduction, and we very much see our, you know, within the GLA we see the mayor's economic and environmental aims as going together. We don't see these as either or. So this puts a whole set of challenges in terms of the economic development side, that this level of economic development has to be maintained while at the same time hitting very stretching carbon reduction and other environmental targets. And finally, on quality of life, we know that quality of life is a key indicator not just of social well-being but also of economic competitiveness. So if people and jobs and firms can move ever more easily around the world, trying to get people and jobs to stay in your city, the quality of life that you can offer, and quality of life meaning everything from the air quality, open space, public realm, through to the quality of health services, the quality of education and so on, is going to be crucial. And now, and I'll show some charts in a moment, London doesn't score particularly, doesn't do badly, but doesn't score particularly highly on quality of life. So that's something where we're vulnerable. Again, just, you know, all very, very basic facts, but I think they're worth remembering. London has had a huge transition from a manufacturing and goods-based economy through to being a service city. So this set of data runs from 1971 through to 2007, and the basic pattern is that cross between manufacturing employment, running top left to bottom right, and business services, note, not financial services, financial services are here, dark blue, but business services going bottom left to top right. So, worth repeating, London has suffered deindustrialisation, you know, on a huge, huge scale over the last 40 years, and the labour market and the economy has adapted by moving very successfully to a service-based economy. What are we particularly good at? This chart shows the index of specialisation across the bottom mapped against the share of London's total output. So, in other words, as you move left to right, these are the sectors which London is particularly specialised in, and then going south to north, how much of a share of the London economy it is. And you can see the two big outliers here are business services and financial services, as you'd expect. So these are the sectors where not only are we very specialised, but these are large chunks of London's output in terms of GVA. And London is much more productive than the rest of the UK, not surprisingly. So on average, about 30% higher productivity in London than the UK, but that does differ quite a lot across sectors. So while in transport, communications, wholesale, retail, and hotels and restaurants, about 22-24%, in this very broad category of other business services, 52% more productive. So this is a highly productive economy, generally across the board, but with some specialisation within that as well. In terms of the sort of global league tables, and this is from the Cushman and Wakefield European Cities Monitor, how well does London do in terms of its attractiveness to business? On many measures, London is consistently ranked number one. This is showing 2005 to 2008, which I need to update, but they don't change very much in the last couple of years either. So availability of staff, access to markets, telecoms, external transport links, language spoken, also, you know, perhaps surprisingly to some people, you know, on internal transport within the city, you know, we're basically number one. On costs, we're always going to struggle against other cities, so cost of staff, we don't score particularly highly, office space, value for money, similarly. And on quality of life, as I mentioned, you know, that bounces around a bit, and I think that's an area where there's a kind of could do better. Big cities like London are never ever going to be number one in a table which includes much smaller cities, and it's always in the Cushman and Wakefield, even more in the Mercer's Quality of Life Index, it's always the Zurichs and Vancouver's and places like that, smaller cities with a high quality of life which come out top. But even allowing for that, we think we can probably do a bit better in terms of comparisons for quality of life with other large cities around the world. Okay, so that's the kind of quick tour around the London economy. As I'm coming back to the LSE, you know, I don't actually dredge out from my brain. These things are always here. What did I learn from all those years working with Ian and Tony and Christine and others here? And I think the things I learned here, which were taught in seminars here, are very relevant to being concerned with practical policy issues for the London economy. First of all, it's about agglomeration or it's about nothing. London's big strength is there's lots of stuff here and it all gets mixed up together, and that is for me, that's what really drives some of those figures and numbers that you've just seen. So going right back to Alfred Marshall, that through Paul Krugman and onto Henry Overman and the work of the centre here, all that theoretical stuff about agglomeration economies is really true when you're looking at why is it that London manages to stay number one in a number of different areas despite all the things that people complain about, and that's because this mix of proximity, innovation, sparking off, and that kind of strength in depth which you get from having a number of different industries brought together, common labour pool, knowledge transfer, all the stuff Alfred Marshall talked about with the industrial districts in the north 150 years ago, absolutely applies to a global city. So coming off that, and then into a bit more detail, the Jane Jacobs argument about economic diversity, not being specialised, new ideas in old buildings, all that sort of stuff we see very, very relevantly today. We're doing, I'll talk a little bit about this later, but we're doing some work with the national government on so-called Tech City East, Silicon Roundabout, coming grow a digital cluster here in London. That is absolutely all about reuse of old buildings, new people with new ideas, in the way which Jane Jacobs and others described. And finally, Ed Glaser, proximity. Proximity is really, really important. So notwithstanding telecoms and all the different ways of communicating, for the key high-end advanced producer services which this city specialises in, you need face-to-face contact. You need regular face-to-face contact, and you need accidental meetings of different kinds. Innovative milieu, I think used to be the word, I don't know if it still is, but it's that kind of idea. You need the right kind of soil for these things to grow in. And that leads into this kind of ongoing debate, which I've tried to summarise here. Is the world spiky or flat, or is it both? In other words, does globalisation flatten the globe so you can actually be anywhere? It doesn't particularly matter where you are. Or does it actually make it more spiky so it matters a lot where you are because that gives you a key competitive advantage? And I think if that's not a cop-out, I think to some extent it's both. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. Just thinking about London's competitive position in this global city system, I think this is the work from the group at Loughborough, and I think the core argument of the World Cities Group at Loughborough there, which essentially puts London and New York in their own category, I think it still applies really. So if we're thinking about London's competitors, it's in a category of which there are very few other members. That doesn't mean that there aren't individual sectors or individual activities which any one of these places that are coloured differently and shown a different size, any one of those places can compete with London and can draw activity away. But as a classification regime, I think they're right in terms of just putting London in a category of two. Just a quick word on spiky worlds, and I don't know whether this has been covered before. I'm still looking for a decent representation of this article by Richard Florida, so I'm using an old PDF here, which is the only version of it I've got. I find this way of representing it very powerful, and I think this is, frankly, this is Richard Florida's best idea. I think this is better than creative cities. If you look at the population, that's what the world looks like. So lots in Europe, quite a lot in America, around the coastal areas of South America and Africa, and then huge concentrations of population right across South and East Asia. You go from population to economic activity, suddenly the world shrinks a lot. Most of the southern hemisphere disappears. Even within the northern hemisphere, it now becomes much more concentrated on the east and the midwest in the US and then across the west coast. More concentration in Europe, and the map of Asia begins to look very different with just a few places spiking up. If you go one stage on, and look at patents, and then it's an incredibly spiky world. So you're talking about two coasts of America, various bits of Europe, Japan and Korea, Israel and Sydney, or rather Tel Aviv metropolitan region and Sydney, and that's about it. And then citations, which if you see that as being one stage before patents, just very crudely, the world shrinks even further. So I find this, although you know, it's a very simple way of showing it, I think this is very compelling in terms of the spikiness of the world. And if we're looking at, if we're correct in thinking that knowledge is the key resource in the same way as coal and iron were the key resources for the Industrial Revolution, then we're talking about a relatively limited number of places that can play in that game. Bringing that down to thinking about London and the South East, this is the sort of understanding which we got through the sort of 90s and into the 2000s from the work of here from Peter Hall and Kathy Payne, but lots of other people working on this. In other words, understanding London as actually not just being the physical boundary of London, but being the greater southeast. That is this very densely interconnected city region or super city region based around advanced producer services, with a very clear geographical imbalance there between west and east, and a lot of the nodes being to the west of London and relatively few to the east. Then if you kind of change the magnification again a little bit, if you start looking at how distributed that prosperity and affluence is within London, almost any indicator you choose, this one is working age adults receiving out of work benefits, but I mean there's a 100 different indicators you could use which would throw up a very similar map to this, i.e. with a crescent of deprivation mostly around this kind of inner southeast core, not entirely, so there are other pockets in other parts of London, but very much this kind of generally west, rather west being more affluent than the east, areas of concentrated wealth, particularly in the west and the southwest, and areas of concentrated poverty in this inner crescent. And I think we've all been, well, some of us have been used to looking at these sort of maps for many years and thinking of that as the geography of London. And there are other ways of beginning to think about this. This hasn't come out terribly well, but this is something I this is actually a map of the world, but it's clearer.
this is Europe. Right? You see Europe as Britain, as the US, as this is India. And this is built up by looking at mapping the location of collaborators on scientific publications between 2005 and 2009. And so again, this is sort of bringing out the spikiness of the world and the concentration, but in a slightly different way. And there are lots of these kind of ways of analysing data which are beginning to come through, some of which show familiar patterns, and some of which show very unfamiliar patterns. So this magic kingdom here, which I didn't recognise at all when I first saw it, is from a PhD student at UCL, maybe in this room today, called the New City Landscape of London. So this is not a London I've recognised. And this is a map taken from data generated on a balmy June day in 2010. These are tweets. This is a Twitter map of London. So this is showing you the density of people tweeting. And this is Soho. So some of this is a very familiar map. This is the kind of West End Central Business District going out a bit on the kind of Hammersmith axis out towards Heathrow. But we have these very interesting, I haven't seen this before, on a kind of socio-economic map of London. This is going down through sort of New Cross Greenwich, and this is going up through Shoreditch and into Hackney. So very broadly, this is the kind of, this is the Art College. This is the Ravensbourne Goldsmith axis here, and this is Shoreditch, Hoxton, Hackney going out
the outlying patch, a little bit further east
there.
That, I'm not sure. That must be further out than Newham, actually, which is about here.
It's the Lee Valley.
Yeah. And you've got something going on up in the Lee Valley.
Anyway, there are people beginning to generate the, because you now have access to data in a very different way, and we've done our bit at the GLA by releasing essentially all our data through what the data store. Anybody can download any of the data that the GLA, including Transport for London, has access to, and that's led to all these new applications which people download onto their smartphones, giving them information on tube movements in real time, or telling you where your nearest bike docking station is free, and so on. But this, you know, this Twitter map, which, as I say, was, and there are similar maps for other cities around the world, just produced by one person working at UCL, I think for the first time, a bit, you know, didn't look like the usual geography. So, question, is the current phase of technological transformation leading to a different kind of spatial configuration in London than the one we've got very used to for the last 30 or 40 years? Okay, so that's sort of the background. Where does the Mayor and the Greater London Authority fit into this? Just to quickly skip through, what is the Mayor's role in economic development? Remembering the Mayor is only one player. Even on the public sector side, we have 33 boroughs plus the City of London. You have government departments which have big spending programmes. We still have various quangos that spend a lot of money in London. So you have to see the Mayor's role as being within that overall system. And the Mayor, the GLA is a strategic authority, and the Mayor has a general power to promote economic development and wealth creation in London under the GLA Act 1999. The Localism Bill, which is currently going through the House, requires the Mayor to prepare and publish an economic development strategy for London. Now, this is quite an important change. In some ways it's a legalistic change, but I think it's a very important symbolic change. The Mayor already has an economic development strategy, but his powers essentially flow from the legislation which created regional development agencies. So for all nine regions, there are regional development agencies, and each one had to have an economic development strategy. In London, that economic development strategy had to be approved of by the Mayor. So he had that power, but it was slightly through the back door. This bill requires him personally to take responsibility for that EDS. The bill also provides for additional housing and regeneration powers, including the power to create mayoral development corporations, of which the first one is expected to be the covering the Olympic Park, and the current Olympic Park legacy company will become a mayoral development corporation. In the EDS, the Mayor's vision is quite straightforward. London should be the best big city in the world, quote unquote. The EDS was revised towards the end, beginning at the end of 2009, and the revised EDS published in May 2010 after a very wide process of consultation with a large number of stakeholders across London. And it was developed alongside the revised London plan and the Mayor's transport strategy. In other words, the idea is the EDS is consistent with and supports the land use planning strategy and also the transport strategy. If you haven't looked at it, it's worth a read. I did write most of it, so I suppose I'm biased, but I think it is a reasonable read. It's not a 180-page strategy document. It's about 40 or 50 pages long, and we did try, as far as possible, to keep the thing in reasonably plain English so that somebody could pick it up and get an idea of what the Mayor's priorities were. And we set it out under five themes there. So the five themes are London as the world capital of business, improving London's competitiveness, transforming to a low-carbon economy, extending economic opportunity, investing in London's future, and that's particularly making best use of the investment that's going in around the Olympics and other major projects, and overall, the overall approach, the EDS is a long-term high-level strategy, so it's a 20-year, covers a 20-year period to 2031. It's deliberately kept high level. It doesn't have a lot of detail, But we took the view that high level doesn't mean vague, or needn't mean vague, so you can be quite precise and quite specific, we think, while keeping it high level and not getting into a huge amount of minutiae. How do we actually do this, given that the mayor is you know, one player among many, and the GLA was set up deliberately to be a strategic body and not a major delivery body? How do we deliver? The strategy identifies actions, what the mayor will do, that is, things which are directly within the powers and competences and finance of the mayor and the GLA group, but also, and more largely, what the mayor will influence, that is, things that are going to be delivered either by other parts of government or in some cases by the private sector. So it's all about the GLA group working closely with a range of partners. It's about the mayor using his strategic and influencing role, which is the heart of the powers he has under the GLA Act. We're doing this in a policy context where the coalition government is closing down or abolishing the 9 regional development agencies, including the London Development Agency, and there the functions and whatever funding remains to the LDA will be folded into the GLA itself. So there's there's a process of organisational change going alongside that, and this is really all about aligning the resources of a whole range of partners towards the mayor's priorities. We're doing that through, alongside the EDS, developing an implementation plan, which is currently in a draft state, which is structured around the actions that are set out in the EDS. And what we aim to do in the implementation plan is set out what sorts of sub-actions are required in order for the EDS to be implemented, being very clear about what things the mayor himself can do, and then where it's an influencing role, who the key players are, and what we're expecting them to do. So that will obviously be worked up as far as possible in a collaborative way. So we need to identify who the key partners are that we work with, and we aim to publish this later in the year. We'd hope really to have the implementation plan out by now, but because of the protracted discussions we had about our settlement from government, about what was going to happen with the LDA, about exactly what was going to be in the localism bill in terms of new powers, this has been pushed back probably 2 or 3 months later than ideally we'd have wanted. Finally then, within that kind of overall strategic approach, What are the key issues for us? What are the key issues that, you know, my team worry about and try to do things about? Well, first of all, going back to where I started with economic diversity, maintaining economic diversity is key, and I prefer that phrase to rebalancing the economy, because I think rebalancing is completely the wrong metaphor. It's as if government can just get in and tinker around with a huge global economy like London's, and it can't. But having an eye out for maintaining economic diversity, which means, yes, continuing to support London as the world capital for finance and business services, absolutely 100%, but also recognising that even under the most favourable conditions, you're probably not going to get the same level of job creation, certainly in financial services, that you saw over the last 15 years. So there have got to be other things going on in the economy. Looking at, first of all, sectors where we are a world leader, although often, you know, you might not be aware of it, particularly, let's say, media, culture, creative. London is home to about 6 of the world's leading global media brands. The FT is here, The Economist is here, the BBC is here, and yet, you know, if you stop people in the street around the world and ask them, you know, name a global media capital, they wouldn't think of London. If you ask for a tourist destination, or you ask for, you know, where is financial services mostly headquartered, they'd probably come out with London in the first 2 or 3 things they said. I referred to digital and tech, and we're working closely with the government on their initiative at the moment, which is both, for us, it's both a specific initiative around East London, including the Olympic Park, but it's also about trying to do more with London's natural advantages as a digital capital, i.e. we not only have some key firms and some rapidly growing startups, but this is also a city which has a concentration of media, advertising, fashion and finance, which, you know, again, going back to Jane Jacobs or going back to agglomeration economies, if you're trying to develop new sectors, new industries, what you want is that crossover between the existing sectors, and London is very well placed to do that. But there'll be many other sectors as well, so diversity is key. Secondly, a whole raft of work around competitiveness, and this is looking at the regulatory framework, both from the UK, although probably more importantly from Brussels, and I say more importantly because much more of the regulation now comes from European law rather than UK law, so we're looking at tax and regulation there. Immigration, which is a key issue for London business, and a key issue for the Mayor in terms of some of the recent changes to immigration policy, are effectively potential threats to UK competitiveness. The reduction in the tier one skilled workers category, potentially other things which will potentially make it more difficult for graduate students to stay in the UK and get a job or start a business. All these are both they're potential threats, both in terms of the way we analyse what London's economy needs, but even more so because London business knock on our door and say this is an immediate issue which we need to do something about. Thirdly, the whole raft of economic opportunity issues. There's no point in having the most prosperous city in the world if that prosperity is only concentrated amongst one part of the population. So we have a range of programmes here where we try and address this. The Mayor strongly supports the London Living Wage, which is the citizen bottom-up citizens campaign for employers to pay not just the minimum wage in London, but the London Living Wage, which is higher than the minimum wage, because it essentially you can't live a decent life on the minimum wage in London because of the additional costs in the city. And that's a good example of where we have no regulatory power there at all. The Mayor can't compel anybody to pay the London Living Wage, but we can persuade, we can promote exemplars, we can publicise that, and we work very closely and very successfully with a number of businesses and with the London Citizens Campaign to promote that. The Mayor's engaged at the moment on a campaign to increase London's level of apprenticeships. London traditionally has a much lower take-up of apprenticeships than any other part of the UK. That's partly because of a perception amongst employers that apprenticeships are all about manufacturing industry. They're essentially about relatively unskilled male jobs which involve wearing overalls and wielding a spanner. And that's an important part of the apprenticeships system, but there are many other sectors for which it applies. The largest single number of apprenticeships in London are in business administration. So we are working very closely with a number of services companies to increase the take-up of apprenticeships. As I mentioned before, tackling worklessness in a whole variety of ways and upskilling the existing workforce as well are also crucial to making sure that all up Londoners have access to the sorts of opportunities which the economy hopefully will be generating. And we do all this, you know, in terms of the key issues, this is within a framework which is a national policy framework which is changing very rapidly. It's not just because there's a change of government, but the new government has very radical ideas in terms of how it wants to change the skills system so it becomes more quote-unquote demand-led. In other words, it's more driven by what employers need and what individuals are want to take on and in many cases are prepared to pay for. In terms of unemployment and worklessness, a move to what's called the single work programme, which is essentially scooping up a whole range of existing welfare to work programmes and turning them into one big delivery system. And the government's wish, having abolished RDAs, to see local enterprise partnerships being set up, which for us it made sense outside London for there to be a variety of local enterprise partnerships, but in London we couldn't see the argument for having several overlapping and competing LEPs. So we have proposed jointly with the boroughs and with London Business to have a single London enterprise partnership covering London. So there's a lot of policy change going on, and in a number of cases it's not clear exactly where that's going to land. We have to, on the basis of the analysis which I very quickly sketched through and the Mayor's priorities as set out in the strategy, we aim to tackle these issues within that overall framework, that the tools for doing that at national level are changing rapidly. Okay, and I'll stop there, and I'm very happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions?
I'd like to ask a couple of questions about where is London. You have some interesting maps, but I didn't say anything about boundaries and the notion of corridors, which certainly used to be form part of the concept of London. There was concepts like the M11 corridor, for example, or West and Wedge, unfortunately. But secondly, you can see London as made up of a number of centres. And for example, our research which shows that there's more employment in other than retail in all the smaller centres you get around in the suburbs. Yeah. And I just wondered whether, if you had more time, you would have endorsed those sorts of ideas, or whether there's fresh thinking.
Yeah, I think on that, if I had more time, I certainly would have put up some of the London plan diagrams, which show both those corridors, Western Wedge, M11 corridor, Thames Gateway, and also bring out the point about there are centres of employment and employment growth in outer London as well as in inner London. So this, you know, I mentioned this before, but maybe just to, you know, emphasise it a bit more. The EDS you should read very much alongside the London plan. So the London plan and the approach that's taken there in terms of sub-regions, corridors, areas of opportunity and all the rest of it is absolutely what we work with. But what we didn't do is then in the EDS go into great detail about so many jobs here, so many jobs there.
Okay, that's true.
Yeah.
Then surely you've got to think of a boundary that's much larger than the boundary of outer London. Both because of where people live who come to work in London, but also because some of the best prospects will be outside of that. I'm thinking, for example, you mentioned Silicon Roundabout.
Yeah.
Having been in Stanford, it seems an extraordinary concept, but because people in Stanford, he's like to be in the West Coast because it's a nice place to live, and you might imagine if you were...
So is East London. It's a very nice place to live. Yeah.
You look towards Cambridge.
Yeah.
And they've got a route there, I said, Harlow.
Yeah.
and you wouldn't sort of draw the boundary just at Enfield.
Yeah, I think, and this is, you know, for LEPs, I think we're quite, you know, we're quite sceptical about LEPs in some ways, but I think one real positive thing they could do is a way of actually articulating some of this fuzzy geography, for want of a better word. So, in terms of, you know, the Mayor's remit runs to the boundary of, you know, the Greater London area, and that's it. We're not, you know, we're not going to change. Please don't suggest it to the Mayor, because he would take it very seriously, probably. But you know, that's what we've got. But we know the economy works in a whole load of different ways, so we need mechanisms for doing that. And I think we've always struggled, you know, for decades really, with how do we actually get this articulated. I would like to see a lot of the LEP work focused on that, because that could be a way of doing it. So, you know, fuzzy boundaries as much as they're possible. I think with the Silicon, you know, Silicon Roundabout is a great title, because it's just got that brilliant sort of British ironic self-deprecation thing. But the key thing about that East London cluster was, and it's still pretty small, but it grew very rapidly over a period of 18 months in the middle of a depression, when there was absolutely no government support at any level or even acknowledgement of it. So at the very least, you think that's a natural phenomenon which is worth looking at. And it may be that the correct policy responses don't do anything, just keep out of the way and see what happens. But there'll be lots of other examples, you know, that's one at the moment where the spotlight's on, there'll be lots of other examples like that of things that are going on at the moment in the undergrowth. And we're very much about how do you create the conditions for those sorts of things to grow without leaping on it with a huge public sector programme which is going to sort of kill the, strangle the life out of it.
Can you tell us where the roundabout is?
Oh, sorry, this is Old Street roundabout. This is, yeah. Almost as lovely as Palo Alto.
Can you
tell me
on the
left?
I'm curious about this. So the mayor and the boroughs have gone from one kind of left for London and wrong.
Yeah.
But did that preclude outer London boroughs from joining in less with other areas?
We would, I'll choose my words carefully here. We would prefer that they would do that within the framework of a single Let for London, which would have as part of its remit, how do you work with either local authorities or Lets or whatever they are elsewhere in the greater South East, like say along the M11 corridor, to use NITS.
But you said the boroughs were united behind.
The proposal is jointly from the boroughs and London councils, so which represent
from each of the boroughs.
As articulated through the structure of 33. It's quite difficult to keep 33 people all walking exactly in step all the time.
And the position of Gateway?
The position of Gateway is we would like there to be to be a single Let for London, which would include the London Thames Gateway bit of it. There is a new governance structure for covering the whole of the Gateway. Remember, the Gateway isn't just a bit in London, and there's already an approved Let for Kent, Essex, and
East Sussex.
There we are. So that's already a bit of kit there.
Yes, Mark, you'll be familiar with this question.
You may be familiar with the answer, Mark.
when you talk about threats to London's prosperity, you mentioned workers and some of those skills, and I think it's bad news for the people who are the workers who have those skills in London. But what is the real evidence that it's a real problem, a serious threat to the dynamism of the London economy?
Yeah. I think, I'll answer that in a slightly different way, because even if it has no impact, it's still a problem, because you've then got concentrations, which are mostly spatially concentrated, of people who are not accessing that. And that in itself is an issue.
It's a social problem.
So it's a social problem, but it will then have a spillover effect in terms of areas which are perceived as areas for investment. And there is, I agree with the premise of your question. In the end, there is never a skill shortage problem in London, because you can always get people from somewhere, but at what cost are you getting that, both in terms of the wage cost and in terms of the cost that they're bearing, which show up somewhere in the system. And you can see this to some extent where, how does that articulate with a particular debate about immigration? And as I say, we've been pretty strong in lobbying government about you need to keep London as an open city, and London came out number one in the British Council's open city study. You need to keep London as an open city, but they're still sitting underneath that. There's an issue of, well, how come for a number of key sectors people are only looking to bring people in because they are saying we cannot find the key skills within the London workforce? That's got to be a cost, even with the most liberal immigration policy you can imagine.
Don't employers always say that?
Always say what?
They're short of skills.
Well, no, because I think generally they say
they're half successful.
Yeah, but they generally don't say that, because I say they can recruit from somewhere, so it will come out in some other way. They will say the transport system in London is terrible, whereas in fact it isn't terrible, but it's if your workforce is mostly travelling over a large distance, at any one time some bit of that is not going to work properly.
Okay, I just think most surveys suggest that employers in areas that are doing half decently are quite inclined to say that they have a problem with skill shortages, but it's not peculiar to London.
Yeah,
it's a reflection of success, it's not a problem.
Yeah, but I think, like I say, you have to probe what they mean, and I think there are some areas where there is a genuine skill shortage. So, for instance, seems to me, I wouldn't say we've done this exhaustively, but in the tech sector, we don't produce enough engineers, full stop, with the right skills in Britain. That is just, and that's a kind of long-term issue. So, if you want certain things done, and there are other places which have a lot more are the people with those skills. You have to bring them in.
Linked to that, really, is the implication is either that we struggle to deal with the lack of skills, or we kick them out.
Yeah.
Which suggests that we might be in favour of a certain of current government policy.
No, I think you've got to have a short and long term. Even if we knew exactly how we'd have to change the HE training whatever systems, which, you know, I wouldn't pretend that there's a solution to that instantly. Even if there was, you're talking about a delay of many, many years for that to come through. So you need to look at whether your immigration policy allows in the right level of skilled workers while still working on, are there kind of some permanent shortages here? And should we do something about it? Because you might take the view that actually we're not going to be competitive in this particular sector, and we'll just leave it. We'll be, you know, that will grow somewhere else, and we'll just, you know, we won't put that much of public sector resource into trying to grow that or keep that within Britain, in the same way that, you know, when we closed down the mines, it wasn't that we're never going to burn coal, it's just somebody else produces coal cheaper than we can here. And, you know, in the end, national government can do that, but I think from a London perspective, we don't want to get over-specialised. So you don't want to say, we're just going to do financial and business services equally. I don't think you want to say, you know, the bankers have caused too much trouble, let them all go to Switzerland. You know, that would be a disaster. So you've got to have economically. Personally, you might like it, but you know, you've got, it's that diversity which is the thing that's keeping this huge economy afloat.
This is sort of a practical question. Everyone, for as long as I've worked in generation, which is about 10 years, everyone said that we need to give employers more influence on skills.
Yeah.
And then people go and try and talk to employers, and employers say we've got skill shortages. And then whenever it gets to the point of actually getting the mechanisms together to make employers have more influence on skill provision, it seems to fall down, either because no one can design the mechanism, or because in the end employers are too busy running their businesses
for
the time.
Yeah.
To influence skills provision. So have you got any sort of ideas on how to
resolve
that?
I recognise that description. I'm probably the first thing to say, I think it is worth getting employers involved in this, but it's a really long haul because, for a number of reasons. One is because most employers are too busy to do this, so you've really got to, because you want the right people, and you've really got to persuade them. The other thing is, they've got to go through this enormous, horrible learning curve where they actually begin to understand how the incredibly complicated world of the public sector works. And they have got to understand that, because, and I think if you can get them through that, you then get some real value added out of them, because they're able to use their knowledge and expertise with some understanding of the constraints. Otherwise, you either get employers who just get fed up, I mean, or tend to say quite reasonable but, you know, rather simplistic things, because, you know, just, can't you just fix this sort of thing? So it's pretty tricky, and you've got to identify your key people, and you've got to give them some real say in the system. You know, if it just looks like lip service, like we come and consult you once a quarter.
Couldn't we be trying to simplify the public sector?
Yeah, I would like to do that. I still don't understand why the skills system is so complicated, because I've read Stephen Hawking's book, and I probably understand 80% of that. So, but I couldn't describe to you the skills system in England, you know, in five overheads or something. So I don't really understand. It does seem to be more complicated than almost any other bit of public policy.
So you mentioned quality of life of threats for London economic development. So are there any specific strategies that the GLA aim at implementing to enhance quality of life? And is it specific geographical areas? Does it target only business people? What sort of practical strategies are there?
Yeah, there's quite a lot that goes on in terms of, you know, general quality of life for Londoners. And I suppose from my end of it, it's that I think my argument would be these things have a practical economic benefit, even though their core purpose is not towards economic development. So things like public, the mayor's public realm strategy. So there's money put into improving the public realm, so it's just a nicer place to be. Work on open spaces, work on more walking and cycling, the transport investment, and so on. All those things, which, you know, they're not done with an aim of economic development, are probably as important as almost anything else in terms of improving the offer of London. There are then other key bits of quality of life which are not really within, or the mayor has some influence, but they're not really within his domain. So the quality of education, quality of schools in London, health services, some of those other direct services, we know have a big impact on whether people choose to come to London and to stay here. But the mayor's only going to ever have some indirect effect on that.
I think it's quite difficult to decide whether one should be optimistic or pessimistic, and I'm not sure you give as much guidance on this, I won't lie. Many of the issues that you raise, which I feel like important supply-side inputs to London economy, are matters which are highly contentious and difficult, and we all know what they are. They're immigration policy, Richard Lambert, gave a quite thoughtful summary, and also mentioned airline policy, which is a very London-specific issue.
Yeah.
The cost in London is, London is an extremely expensive city in which to do anything. It's also a very slow city to do anything, particularly both on spatial planning, though to be fair, the London plan itself was quite a speedy document, but the development frameworks certainly are not. Development control is notorious, and likely to become more complicated.
Yeah.
You've mentioned shortages in labour market, which I say is a contentious issue on both major parties. It's not easy to see, given the growth of global competition, Asian and BRIC countries and so on, why you come over as, you know, we've got a few problems here, but it's going to be all right on the night. There are plenty of examples, and there are certain examples of cities in Britain who were great years ago and are nowhere now. And it seems to me it's perfectly possible to create a scenario which suggests London actually is going to lose its global position.
Yeah. Good question. A bit hard to work for Boris and not be optimistic. Just as a matter of course. But no, I think, you know, I would be pretty optimistic in terms of a kind of fundamental analysis of the strengths of the London economy. Because I think, you know, there are some deep causes for London's competitive position, which we can continue to exploit. So I'm pretty positive about that. The things I think are much, much more difficult to crack. I think the whole kind of skills, worklessness, what we used to talk about as social exclusion, I think is very, very deep-seated. And you can foresee a scenario in which the London economy continues to prosper, maybe not quite the growth rate of the last 15 years, but there's relatively little inroad into those concentrations. You know, I think that's quite plausible. The other thing which I think is worrying is, you know, and you have to put aside some of your personal views on this, but, you know, I think there's a danger that there could be a perception at government levels, this government or anyone else, that it doesn't really matter if London stops being a financial centre. And sometimes, some of the statements you hear, it's almost as if it doesn't really matter if it all went. And that would be completely disastrous. So that the fact that that basic competitiveness argument is difficult to articulate at the moment, when there's a lot of justified public anger about banks and all the rest of it, but that could really lead to, you know, if it doesn't play out in the right way, you could see London's competitive position being eroded. And I think the view we've always taken is that you need to look not just at a kind of sudden change, as if everybody's decamped overnight, but you need to look at what decisions are being made by major institutions, and even if they maintain a London presence, are they trying to grow here, or are they actually putting their new bits of business somewhere else? And over a period of time, that salami slicing could wear away. Now, if you want to flip that around the other way and be more optimistic, when you're looking at sectors like digital and tech, you know, a lot of these companies are never going to move from the US, but there can be particular functions which they might choose to locate in London, which has got world-class universities, it's got world-class biomedical research. It's a relatively easy place to bring in lots of young, clever people because they like being here. So, you know, you don't have to have the whole shooting match for London to begin to grow. But equally, the other way around, you could actually begin to lose some of the cutting edge. And I agree. And we're very mindful within the GLA. You know, we look at examples. I mean, one good example, you know, Italy 15 years ago was top of all the tourism destinations, so they stopped investing in it and it's now gone down to whatever, 11, 12, you know, you don't, just because you're there doesn't mean you have it in perpetuity, and you can lose your position, and once you start losing it, that can then be a self-feeding process.
Yeah, I was interested in the sort of geographical dimension, I suppose, in a bit more detail. To what extent there is a geographical dimension to the economic strategy? In other words, I mean, for example, there are things, at the moment the London plan takes sort of east, basically because the land is there, and it's not really much more sophisticated than that. I just wondered, and things have come along.
Shocks.
I've actually taken advantage of the space and relatively cheap, but it happened largely. For accidents, the right word, it's been fortuitous in some sense.
Yeah.
And you talk about Tech City. I mean, to what extent is that example? An example of London sort of shedding its skin and saying we can't carry on competitively around the white city and we've got to do something else.
Yep.
Or to what extent is it we've got all these kind of problems in East London and there's still an opportunity, so we'll do something there. So it's a rather sort of gullible question, but to what extent is there something that says this is our growth strategy, and actually there are things we need to do, and that growth, the success of our growth strategy, does have a geographical dimension.
Yeah.
Maybe West London.
Yeah, I think. Well, first of all, I'm sure my London Plan colleagues would disagree violently with the idea that it just says, you know, go east, young man. Doesn't say other things. It does say a lot of other things. I think the spatial, you know, the spatial bit of the EDS essentially. We lift from the London Plan. So that view of London's geography and London's development is the one we incorporate in that. And the reason why we don't do anything different from that is not just because of consistency, but because, the intellectual framework underpinning this is the role of government is to create the conditions in which people make the decisions for economic prosperity to thrive. This is not, you know, it's the opposite of, you know, Peter the Great saying, right, I'm going to build St. Petersburg here. It's the complete opposite of that. So we try as little as possible to say here rather than here, or that sector rather than that. Now, having said that, you have a real geographical space and you have real decisions about, you know, transport investment and all the rest of it. So the framework that's within the London Plan in terms of opportunity areas and so on, we see as being carried through in the EDS, but we really don't see it as our role to be that kind of dirigist top-down planning. And I think that's a very important, clear philosophical message, you know, really from the mayor downwards, that's the way he looks at these issues.
Although I think
I just said they wouldn't agree. I didn't say who was right.
What you say about trying to give receipts, but at the same time, are there certain characteristics of the city which will need to be put in place for this sort of growth strategy to succeed?
Yeah.
In which case, that does lead you. I'm not saying you should say we're going to try and invent the old kind of there, which draws you to one place which has the right mix of infrastructure and skills. And the interesting thing about that is it probably isn't taken to a location, or it may not be taken to a location. Not a lot has happened in a lot of those locations. On the Olympic site, which is potentially the best site in certain Western Europe, if I'm not mistaken, but you seem to want to put lots of housing on it, for example. You know, to what extent is the opportunity and the need
Yeah.
cross-referencing with the reality?
Yeah, well, it's a very complex geography. So you've got basically 1,000 years of looking west ever since, can't remember, Edward the Confessor's father built the, you know, built the church at Westminster. It's always been west, given a huge boost obviously by Heathrow in the war. But then you've had 40 years now nearly, of a pretty consistent build east and put the infrastructure in. And in as I think a lot of things in terms of British policy, when you look at it with hindsight, it all looks completely logical. I mean, those of us at the time knew it was anything but it does look pretty consistent from the LDDC through to the investment into the Olympic Park, you know, the Dome, and now beginning to think about the Royals and Thames Gateway. That is actually a fairly consistent strategy. But, you know, that's within a context where there continue to be a huge number of drivers towards the west. Now, you know, if we closed down Heathrow and built an airport in Thames Estuary, it would all be very different, but, you know, that's probably not going to happen next week or next month. So, you know, those pulls are still going to be there.
Martin?
Yeah, going back more to the role of financial sectors, analytically, where do you place business services? Because you
have
that very striking diagram that showed how important it is and how specialised it is. So it's really very, very important. And I wasn't clear whether you were saying that in a way financial services is the leading sector and this lot bustling behind it, or is it a separate sector? I mean, you know, Nick Banks once said, it's a pity there isn't a worshipful company of services not elsewhere specified. it is huge.
Yeah.
I don't know an enormous amount about it and what its potential is. And I think whether there's been much work on that and where you placed it in relation to, is it, as I say, is FES a leading sector? Is financial services a leading sector in FES? Or is it sort of equal first up there, and therefore the city and the West End do separate jobs?
Yeah.
I think you were using the old SIC there. If you use the new SIC, then there's two sectors that London specialises in dramatically. One's finance and the other's information, communications, and publishing, and all that stuff up together. And so it's not a great mystery, and it's consistent with some of the things you're saying, but they exist alongside each other.
So alongside, not one downstream of the other?
Yeah.
Well, on that, the business service category is huge, so in a sense it doesn't really tell you that much to say this is so big, although I still think the growth of that is significant. I don't think we know enough about what that relationship is. Is it a primary-secondary relationship? So it's financial services that matters, and these are all downstream things, lawyers, accountants, IT supporting it. Is it more symbiotic, or is it some mixture of the two? I suspect it's some mixture of the two, because I think if financial services disappeared, a lot of business services would also disappear. But I'll bet, because of the strength of the business services sector, particularly advanced producer services, lawyers, accountants, all the rest of it, that's part of the competitive advantage as to why banks and other financial institutions should locate here. But I'm yet to see anything that really teases that out in that kind of way.
Can I say, 11 years existence of GMA, I think it was now, nobody there's ever made any effort to investigate this question.
Well, we'll start now.
There used to be annual London Business Service, which never got analysed, even though they had some material
to
that. There's a deliberate effort, it seems to me, to obscure this question.
Well, I think as I'm fair to say, it's to obscure it. But I think it's...
The story is that finance drives everything. Yeah. And there hasn't been a shred of evidence,
actually. I mean, if they were growing on the back of financial services, then those axes would imply that somehow, from a period when every financial services transaction or person generated another equivalent business services person, they're now somehow generating four, which obviously financial transactions have got more complicated, but it seems unlikely that they are generating four times as much in terms of sort of ancillary demand for other services.
Yeah, remember those charts looking at jobs, so you'll get a different picture with GVA per head, and you'll get a different picture, you know, if you look at other things, I guess, like profit and turnover and so on. But, you know, I wouldn't pretend that we've got a kind of consistent story about that, but I don't think, you know, as I say, I've yet to see anything that can actually pull out that complexity of that relationship.
Yeah, please.
Yes.
Economic pattern or initial idea, because he plays it right after the patterns and how the world looks like. But is there an intention, I mean, for instance, if you compare being in New York as the main competitor in the piano chart, it's much easier to access, for instance, public free Wi-Fi in New York for business and for, I mean, you just walk around, you open your computer and you work.
Yeah.
And here it's actually relatively difficult.
It is.
You buy an app and then you roll and you go and pay sort of money for coffee and so forth. Isn't that element really publicly available, or is that a tension now with government and wanting, because obviously private sector, I'm sure BT wouldn't support us because I tend to buy a lot of, spend a lot of money on BT basically when I work somewhere in the land, not being in the office, the private office. Yeah, but that seems to me something that could support a lot of the economic strategies, very pragmatic.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the sort of issue which we're trying to push up the agenda much faster. In terms of, as you say, free Wi-Fi, so some of the suggestions around are, okay, we'll have free Wi-Fi everywhere in Shoreditch or everywhere in the Olympic Park, but why not everywhere in London? You know, because you're right. But I think that's the sort of issue which has been, until comparatively recently, just was not on the radar here. I mean, we, you know, in the GLA, we set up the data store, you know, where, about 18 months ago? You know, at that point, really, nobody knew what we were talking about. And it's still a huge battle to get other private and public agencies to release the data. There's a battle going on at the moment with ATOC, which represents all the train companies outside London. They want to hang on to the data. The point is, when we released the data on the bike scheme, the bike usage, within, I think, less than 24 hours, there were four apps on the iPhone you could choose between telling you where it was. If we'd have kept hold of the data, it would have taken a year minimum, and then it wouldn't have worked properly. So, you know, you just, it's a completely different way of thinking about things, and it's based around the idea, really, that you enable. And, you know, we would love to have free Wi-Fi everywhere, but, and we engage in conversations with BT and various other people about how we can get to it. But I think we are trying to have, having to catch up with a lot of other places on this.
So, yes.
Are there powers that you don't have to promote business development or something that you'd like to have, you know, on the record or off the record?
On the record. On the record, we are very happy with all the powers we have in the localism bill, blah, blah, blah. And I think, seriously, I think, you know, there's quite enough there to be going on with for the moment. I think, you know, as a personal view, if you're looking at the long-term development of a mayoral system or a local government system generally, there needs to be some movement on fiscal devolution. So, you know, if you still have a system where 96% of the taxes are collected centrally and doled out, you know, that puts a break on what you can do. And, you know, there are some encouraging noises from government, but most new governments make encouraging noises about this, and then other things seem to intervene. But I think that's probably the next set of things. I think in terms of, you know, my own personal view, if you look at the set of powers the mayor will have when this bill goes through, which will be the third piece of legislation, to me that looks like a reasonable set of powers for a strategic mayor. The original bill, the original act didn't have that. It had strong powers in transport and planning, but it had a number of gaps elsewhere. After two more pieces of legislation, it probably is about where you want. I mean, just to say, you know, also on the back of that, the principle of there being two tiers is very important, and that's one which the mayor fully supports. You know, the kind of double devolution idea. More needs to come down from central government. Some of that should go to the mayor. Some of that should go to the boroughs. Maybe some of that should go, you know, at a more neighbourhood level than boroughs. So it doesn't all have to accrete at the mayoral level, but it certainly has to come down more from central government.
I want to come back to the spatial distribution of economic activities. The mayor started off very gung-ho about promoting out to London with one commission. And now we hear very little about actually promoting the economy in out to London. Have you given up?
No, the mayor has not given up on the Outer London economy, and I think, you know, from the work of the Outer London Commission onwards, it was clear that we support the view that those places can be economic generators as well as residential places. But what, you know, what's the specific ask in different places? And it's quite difficult, and I think this is one of the issues that the Commission had to struggle with. You can't support every potential sub-centre, and how do you actually choose which ones to promote, and to what extent should be in the, should anybody be in the business of choosing some against others? And I think, you know, that's probably where the current discussion is. But it's certainly not the intention that, you know, if we don't have an economy anymore really where everybody has to, you know, converge on a central point, and that's the only source of employment. And we're, you know, we're looking at as many ways as possible of trying to diversify that. But come back to, you know, if London's role is a, you know, advanced producer service global city, then agglomeration and concentration are going to be key drivers of that.
Because that's what you should be incentivized to do. If you take Harrow, for example,
yeah,
that's the headquarters of Ipsos Mori, a major organisation,
yeah,
business services. Ipsos Mori complained bitterly about the quality of the bus station. If you're interested in creative industries, you move over to Wood Green and you find one of the biggest clusters of creative activity anywhere in the world. Again, the quality of the public realm is appalling. There are no funds to do the modest things that are needed to upgrade, to make it easier to walk and cycle and so on, particularly if you're a woman, it feels awful. Shouldn't one you be saying these places are important and as important as the Old Street Roundabout?
Yeah, well, they are important. Are they as important? I don't know. I mean, I need to see that. And remember, we're now, you know, we're in a different world than we were even a short number of years ago, where everybody's budget is down. So everybody is looking to, you know, where they can stop doing things, whether it's a borough council or it's a quango, might well be disappearing, or it's the mayor's budget. And we got a reasonably good settlement for London. We did all right in terms of the major transport projects. But, you know, across the piece, nobody's talking about expanding. We're talking about making difficult choices within the existing set of things we're doing. So that's not to make an excuse, but that means the conversations that happen are of a completely different hue than they were even a couple of years ago.
Can I take you back to the outer London Commission?
On which I'm not an expert, so, you know.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, but then avoided it.
Yeah.
So there's an argument from some places, notably from TfL, actually, that if you wanted if you could concentrate development in a few points within outer London, you could actually change prospects. And you could, and particularly, you could put in some orbital links of a more efficient kind. And the mayor seemed as though he was in favour, for one reason or another, of boosting development in outer London. But he was also in favour of all power going to the boroughs. It was quite clear that boroughs couldn't agree on any census outside their own borders, or sometimes inside their own borders. So it seems that the dilemma here is exactly the one you were hinting at, which is that if you want to make a difference in areas like outer London and take advantage of agglomeration economies and local enterprises, somebody's got to take some leadership.
Yeah, but we live in a two-tier system in which there is no appetite for, what's the phrase, you know, an imperial approach. And, you know, there are a huge number of advantages of having that kind of two-tier system and having a decentralised aspect to where political power is in a big city, but there are also disadvantages, and, you know, that's one of them.
That's the problem, Mark, is you've got a two-tier approach, both of which are the wrong geography. But if you're a London wide geography, which is never been actually able to differentiate different economies within it, and you've got borough economies, which are fundamentally wrong for dealing with you. That's why we ended up with West London Wedges and Thames Gateways and Lee Valley, to try and address that point.
Yeah.
And that's we're seeming to lose track of this that we've actually got, and we're returning to an organisation which is geographically disconnected with the actual economic problems we're trying to face.
No, I think I completely disagree with that. I mean, first of all, the geography's wrong, well, so what? The geography's always wrong. The geography is always, always wrong, everywhere, full stop. So, you know, get over it. It's how do we work with the fact that the boundary, and there's a very good reason for that, because, you know, any economic geography, almost any economic geography, is never going to work, make sense politically. You know, our economy is the Greater Southeast. You know, no one's going to identify with that. So we have to work in an imperfect world where the political and economic geographies don't align. In terms of, you know, I would say at the moment we have a much better sense of actually understanding the London economy and exactly what our role and the public sector role is within that than possibly we've had in the past, and that is that, you know, a lot of it is driven by private sector processes over which the public sector is going to have an imperfect set of levers. Given that, you need to focus attention on where you can have most influence and most effect and not try and do everything. That would be true anyway. When public sector budgets are being reduced, that becomes even more true.
140 characters, Martin. When you describe the local as a 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 when you describe